Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There are large numbers of kids on drugs in America these days. But today we're not talking about the illicit stuff. Instead, the millions receiving medical care for conditions like ADHD, mood disorders, and behavioral problems. Many others receive special services because they've been placed at the high-functioning end of the autism spectrum. These children don't often appear disabled in any way, but they can indeed face developmental challenges, and overwhelmingly it is their mothers we either praise or criticize for how they cope. As my guest today will tell us, what we expect from those mothers and what help they receive can be deeply affected by gender, race, and social class. Linda M. Blum is Associate Professor of Sociology at Northeastern University. Her new book is called Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. Linda, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Before we hear from all the engaged and loving fathers out there, explain to us why you decided to focus specifically on mothers here rather than parents in general.
Yes, it's a great question, and of course I get asked that a lot. Well, first of all, we know from a large body of research on families raising kids with all kinds of disabilities, also physical disabilities, cognitive disabilities, we know that we tend to see reversion to a more traditionally gendered division of the household responsibilities and the caregiving. And we know already from a great body of research that, you know, when there are higher caregiving needs, it does tend to revert to this more traditional women's position. So I simply didn't feel the need to, you know, re-uncover that. That's pretty well established. But I also felt, you know, strongly that something you just mentioned, Chris, which is, you know, culturally, we know that we haven't really changed that far, that, you know, mothers are still primarily held responsible for child outcomes. Our beliefs are still that, you know, primarily the child reflects the mother and her fitness and her caring and her work. And I think that has not changed. And certainly, you know, cultural studies scholars, for example, who've been interested in how we're understanding the rise of all of these invisible disabilities in children and families, who've made, you know, films, they're in TV shows, we see them in, you know, media images. All of those images and all of those sort of cultural expressions tell us that we're still looking to mothers to be really responsible for this. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was going to say, we hold moms responsible for sort of bringing forth the next generation of productive citizens. Are mothers still being blamed for the fact that their children have problems, or are we enlightened enough about neuroscience and psychology now to stop doing that?
I was very interested in that, and that was kind of my question starting this research. Because, right, it's not that long ago that we directly blamed mothers for causing autism in their children, specifically that we thought the theories were that they're cold, frigid, the refrigerator mothers that are the cause of autism in their children. And that wasn't really that long ago. So I wanted to see how mothers were understanding this now with all the new discoveries in neuroscience and about the brain. And, you know, what I discovered is very interesting is that we don't blame as much in that direct way, but we do blame in a secondary way that's really very difficult, very challenging. It's really very unrelenting because you may not be the direct cause of your child's struggles, but you're going to be held responsible for, you know, managing their development, managing these issues, you know, finding every available treatment and service and educational, you know, assistance and every kind of expertise that you can uncover to bring to bear to help your child. And that this is very unrelenting and really ceaseless. And so this is hard in a new kind of way.
One common thread in the many stories you share here is the need for these mothers of children with invisible disabilities to become like experts in these pretty esoteric fields. You know, they have to know how to navigate special services that might be available from schools or from community organizations. They often end up treating advocacy for their kids like another job.
Yes, it really is. The workload is very high. You are delving into everything from the educational system and all the aspects of the educational systems to lots of new specializations in the medical system. And, you know, it's ironic because myself coming from a field of training as a social scientist, and we want to understand, you know, institutions in the social world, but, you know, some specialize in education and some specialize in the medical system. They don't have to specialize in both. But I thought, this is so hard for me, but wow, these mothers, because they don't have that choice. They have to navigate both sets of, you know, very complex institutions. And they're having to do this all the time. And, you know, it is a really large workload.
I was fascinated to learn that Black children are diagnosed with the kinds of problems that we've been talking about at higher rates than their white peers, but they are medicated at lower rates. What did you learn about what might account for that?
Yes, it's very complicated. It's very complicated. It's not perhaps what we might think, you know, and it's also, we don't know, is this good or is this bad? You know, certainly it's worrisome, and people in the education field and those concerned with civil rights and education have been concerned with the disparities over some time now that we do see children of color and particularly boys much more likely to be relegated to special ed. And at the same time, I think we thought that they were probably then higher rates of medication, but they're actually not. And they are lower rates than compared to similarly, even at the same socioeconomic level of white kids with maybe similar issues. So it's a very complicated issue. Some of those who study this in the aggregate level have, you know, thrown out suggestions. Maybe this is about unequal access to good health care. And if that's part of the problem, then that's certainly not a good thing. But what I was also finding in talking in depth to mothers is that they're concerned that their kids may be being targeted because they lack white privilege. They're very concerned about that. So when they are being pressured to medicate their kids or feel they are being pressured, they're much more questioning. They're much more likely to worry that their kids are really being unfairly targeted. But it's, you know, it's a complicated question because no mother that I spoke with feels good about medicating their child. This is not something that is ever an easy decision. It's a very agonizing decision. But I think particularly for those raising children of color, they're aware of these historical legacies, that we were more likely for so long to think of children of color as deficient, as not as smart, you know, that they have to be very careful about that. At the same time, they want their children to have that great education that we all want for our kids. And so if the medication will be something that allows them to stay in school, succeed in school, that's very important too. So there, you know, are really big questions also when you know that, which they are aware of, that children of color are targeted in other kinds of ways as well, more likely to be suspended, more likely to be expelled from school, and so more likely then to drop out of school, and then more likely to be, for example, involved in the juvenile justice system. So they're aware that, you know, in a society with persisting problems of race inequality, this is a tougher decision for them. So they had some, you know, I learned a lot listening to the way that they struggled with these choices.
Certainly we know that on the one hand, you know, parents in America, regardless of socioeconomic status or race, have a lot in common with one another. And yet we know that those things can also make their experiences very different. What got you thinking about the extent to which economic inequality and race and social class would cause these mothers' experiences to be even more different than those just raising neurotypical children?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, because you do need more resources. It really does require more access to resources. It requires more time. And we're at a time of rising inequality in this country and really worrisome kind of extremes of inequality developing now that we hadn't seen, you know, for decades and decades. And our beliefs about that are changing. But I think that when we think about raising our children also, we are more worried about what their opportunities will be. And so I did think this would really raise a lot of challenges. I also think it informs that we are diagnosing more kids. Because as you introduced this, the program today by saying, you know, these are kids who are in many ways higher functioning in some aspects. They look perfectly normal, you know, and why is that? You know, because I think there's more at stake now. We have, you know, we have less of the good opportunities, and those good opportunities that we have are, you know, we talk about them as the knowledge-based industries, the innovation-based industries, you know, these ways that it may not be enough to have a normal brain power anymore, you know, that your children may need to have the superior brain power to really succeed in this kind of innovation-based economy. And so that I think we're more focused on these issues now, and they become something now that we mark off, whereas in the past, these were relatively more subtle differences that maybe we weren't that concerned with, that your child was quirky, your child was different, but it wasn't necessarily so marked off.
We're speaking this hour with Linda M. Blum, Associate Professor of Sociology at Northeastern University and author of the new book Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Associate Professor of Sociology at Northeastern University, Linda M. Blum, author of the new book Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Linda, I want to go back to what you said about the mothers that you spoke to really agonizing over the decision about whether to medicate or not. Understand that this question is not to imply in the least that any of that agony is disingenuous, but did you get the sense that mothers today feel an obligation to articulate the fact that it was a very hard decision to medicate their kids?
Well, that's a great question. Certainly, it's very stigmatized, and there's a lot that I share in the book from their stories of how stigmatized they feel. And certainly, no one, you know, feels good about that, and being questioned by family and friends, you know, about medicating your children. But I think when they talk about how it affects their daily life, and how what it was like, you know, trying different medications, you know, how difficult that was, and just what their day-to-day life was like, I think then, you know, that's more honest and gets beyond, yes, any kind of thing that you might feel you ought to say. Because it really surprised me. I think we have this image that you can do this, you can give your child, you know, Ritalin or Prozac or, you know, all of these wide range of drugs now, too, of all of the, you know, mood stabilizers that I had to go home after talking to these women and look these things up on the internet, you know, of all the things that they were suggested that they try, and how they said, do you want to see my logbooks? Do you want to see my files? You know, and then my daughter was, you know, not eating. She was losing weight. And then we tried Buspar, but then she was getting a tremor. And then, you know, we tried this, but she lost, you know, it had these other problems. She wasn't sleeping, you know, and a mother said to me, you know, finally, I just said, no, we can't. She's been off everything now for a year, and the teachers blame me and say, you know, and think that I'm not really trying, you know, what am I supposed to do? And this is the kind of thing I heard a lot, so that, I don't want to be alarming. Most of these drugs are safe. Although, you know, it's certainly like to know more about their long-term effects. But many of the side effects, while not dangerous, they make daily life, family life very difficult. You know, when growing kids can't, you know, aren't eating, aren't sleeping, when a dose wears off, you're becoming very, very irritable. You know, these just make daily life in a family is very challenging. And I was so surprised mothers are so on their own. They're like managing drug trials. And they're being given very little feedback on, you know, do you want to try this? Do you want to try this? And, oh, you know, you could be on several. I mean, there's a surprising number now that are on more than one drug, on drug combinations. And mothers are really frontline, like healthcare providers, managing these drug trials and researching and becoming lay psychopharmacologists, you know. And while it's very, we could all say, you know, easily say, you know, no one is particularly like proud of this. I think it's more when you hear the details of daily life that you understand, you know, not only is this not a quick fix, but it's enormously adding to the challenges of day-to-day life rearing children.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mary in Corinth. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Chris. Hi, dear guest. I just wanted to make a comment about I'm an African-American mom. I'm raising a 16-year-old African-American boy, and I wanted to talk about some of the stigma involved in my community, within my family, with the decision of medicating. And it was the hardest decision I've ever made. He was diagnosed when he was about 7. He's very social, and so it's not that obvious. So that's another reason why people were saying there's nothing wrong with that boy. He's smart. Just do this, just do that. And we waited till he was about 15, and he has a dad in the home as well. But we waited till he was about 15 to do it, and I wish we'd never even brought it to so many people, because that made the decision even harder. Because most people, not to generalize too much, but I think mental health issues, or not necessarily, but things like that are sometimes dealt with different culturally. And I think it's newer to our community to deal with problems like that medically.
Thank you so much for that perspective, Mary. I really appreciate it. Linda, is there anything you heard in that you want to respond to?
Yes, thank you so much for sharing that. I think that these issues, you know, what women of color, women also in, you know, interracial relationships, raising children of color, or women, I had one woman I spoke with who was white and had adopted an African-American child, you know, they're very aware of also, you know, it's like a two-edged sword, because they don't, on the one hand, you know, to seek help, to seek treatment, to agree to these diagnostic labels, in some ways it reinforces a very negative stereotype of some kind of organic deficiency in children of color, which is a very unfortunate but persisting belief in the U.S. And then on the other hand, if it's going, you know, I'm not opposed to using medication in some cases and appropriately, and where there's other kinds of supports available and other sorts of services available too. It's certainly not the only solution and the only thing that's needed. But, you know, if it's going to really help that child to stay in school and succeed in school, where people of color have not had that full educational equality, then that's important too. So, yes, I hear that, you know, you're caught in this kind of double-edged sword. It's very complicated. And again, I heard her saying also that she went to so many different people. Like, again, it's so much work to seek out all these different specialists. You might want neuropsychiatric evaluation to have, you know, you might want, you know, to see a psychopharmacologist or even a pediatric psychopharmacologist. You know, you have to find out about the disability rights legislation and what your rights are in the schools and what you can ask for in the schools. And, you know, there's just so much that you have to find out.
What did you learn about social support from these mothers' own communities? I'm not talking about services. I'm talking about acceptance from their peers and understanding and the extent to which sometimes caring for a disabled child can be pretty socially isolating.
Yes, I heard a lot about that, and it certainly was that cut across every difference of socioeconomic level, every difference in level of education or type of community or ethnic or racial identity. You know, that really cut across, and that was very painful stories of isolation and mothers telling me, you know, no one wanted to be friends with my daughter, but no one wanted to be friends with me either. Hmm. And it was a stigma that seemed to really affect the family. And people were telling me that, you know, their community, they felt, was threatened. And they were telling me that this is almost seen as if it's something contagious. And we know from also large-scale surveys that these attitudes are pretty widespread, that although people don't want to admit to prejudice, so this is a very low estimate, but about 20% of Americans will say that they would prefer kids like this not be in their child's class. A somewhat higher percentage that will say that they would prefer their kids not befriend kids with such issues. So that's, you know, pretty widely confirmed, and I'd say that's very distressing. You would think also that, you know, we tend to think that those with a higher level of education are more accepting of diversity, are more tolerant of diversity. I found in the large-scale surveys about these kinds of disabilities and the stigma of them have not found that, that the more educated communities, there's not greater acceptance. And then, in fact, some of what I heard would lead me to guess that wealthy communities may be even less welcoming in their schools because they have a lot of advantage that they want to pass on to their children. They have a lot of privilege they want, a cultural capital, we call in sociology cultural capital, that they want to transmit to their kids. And if you have, you know, disruptive kids, kids with various struggles that are going to take, you know, the teacher's time, they're going to take neighbors' time, you know, there may be even less tolerance in wealthy communities. So I heard a lot of very painful stories about even with extended families, having very painful experiences with extended families. And it was also very much what the caller mentioned. These kids look great. Mm-hmm. You know, right. They're right. Attractive, right, kids. And so that in some ways is maybe it's scarier. I mean, people feel like, oh, this could be my child. This could happen to my child, you know? And so that's, or they, and there's a, you know, they don't believe you. They may not believe another mother, you know, that you have to understand that my kid has, you know, various difficulties or various issues or situations are hard for them. And they may just, you know, I had so many mothers saying, you're just too soft on him, you know, or you're too hard on him.
Right. You can always figure out what's right for somebody else's kids, right? Right. Did you find, Linda, in cases where these students who have a diagnosis and have acted up, say, in school, to what extent is that behavior either excused or treated with extra services or treated as a disciplinary issue, depending on whether that student is white, black, Latino, Asian, or whether that student is rich or poor?
Well, it does really vary along those lines. We know that, and that's what I found. And it's very troubling. Because one of the things that concerns me as a sociologist, you know, is in the context of rising inequality, are these kinds of issues actually exacerbating that inequality? And they may be, I think, because these labels are sort of doing different work. If you are rich or poor or, you know, black or white or Latino or biracial, multiracial, these labels are doing different kinds of work. I mean, we have a problem, you know, in this country, fear of violence, where it's often attached to very negative racial stereotypes, and I think those come into play when you're labeling young black men or boys. But one of the things that You know, and some mothers were very aware that this was happening to their young boy and were really very worried because, you know, one mother, her son was large for his age. She was very tall. Her husband was very tall. And they were quite concerned that even as young as six, that he was already starting to be seen that way. He was, you know, she was telling me he was one of the few Black boys in his school. And in that sense, they were very concerned to get the ADHD label. Hmm. They hoped it would protect him. But at the, you know, they, and at the same time, though, you know, she was, had a very high income. She was a professional, very highly educated, had a very good income. She could, she was telling me all the things she did very quickly. She got specialists very quickly. She got special tutoring, summer interventions, you know, all kinds of things that she marshaled to protect her son, that, you know, he, it would be understood that this is a different kind of issues. But she was telling me, you know, that she's very worried she's going to have to stay very closely on top of this. And she was, you know, again, and you think about this kind of inequality that can be exacerbated. She was worried whether she would be able to keep up with her career demands, because this was another kind of work that she knew as a woman of color with a son of color, she was really going to have to pay very close attention.
And so if you're a single parent and your resources are more limited and your time is more limited, all of those problems would be exacerbated.
That's right. That's right. And we know from aggregate studies that, you know, there are a high proportion of mothers who cut back on paid work or drop out. You know, it's 30% of mothers whose kids are diagnosed with ADHD cut back or quit paid work. And then we know with it's double that on the autism spectrum. It's as much as 60% cut back or quit paid work. And those were the kinds of stories that I heard. And yes, for single mothers, it's a very serious question, but I did talk with single mothers who actually quit paid work because they said, you know, this is my full time job, I need to do this now, and so all, yes, for single mother, and now we have, you know, just over a quarter of those raising kids in the U.S. today now are single mothers.
We're speaking with Linda M. Blum, Associate Professor of Sociology at Northeastern University. Her new book is called Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with sociologist Linda Blum of Northeastern University about her new book, Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. And that's where we find Brian on the line in Dallas. Hey, Brian.
Hey, how are y'all?
Very well, thanks.
My question is, I've seen the stress that it puts on mothers. My son's mother, I mean, it is unbelievable. I mean, we've gone from Ritalin to liquid Ritalin to the pill, and we're on Vyvanse. And sometimes I see it as just being, they're using medication as a disciplinary thing so they don't have to discipline the kids. Now, I know that's the way it looks to me. And another problem we have is he doesn't want to eat. You know, he doesn't eat when he's on this medication, and that's troublesome to me, too. So I'm just curious what we do in those situations, you know. I mean, because if we feel like we're pushed to take these medications and make our son take these medications, and I don't have any disciplinary problems with him at home. very much.
So you feel pushed by the teachers at school, is that right?
Right.
What do you?
I'm just curious. Do you think that sometimes the teachers push this on parents just for disciplinary issues?
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Linda?
Yeah, thanks for sharing your experience. I think this happens, but I think actually even many of the mothers that I spoke with don't want to blame the teachers. They also understand, many of them, that this is a public problem. I mean, that's a lot what I'm about with this book, as I wanted to say, you know, we have to stop seeing this as such a private, individual family problem. This is a public problem. I mean, my sister's a public school teacher. One of my brothers is a public school teacher. These are fantastic people. I've got a niece who's a public school teacher. They're doing wonderful work. They don't have enough resources. We're cutting back their resources. You know, one of the mothers I spoke with said, you know, that she felt this pressure and she was really angry about it. But she said, I don't want to blame the teachers. She said, you know, they're expected to do so much more with so much less. And, you know, one mother I talked to is a teacher. And, you know, she doesn't want to medicate her son and she's resisting. She hasn't yet, but she realizes as he gets older, she may have to. But she said, you know, as a teacher, I want to hand them out at the door, you know, because, I mean, this is a public problem. We need so many more resources, you know, back into our schools. We need to treat teachers as the very skilled professionals that they are. We need to stop kind of blaming that. I mean, I'm all about we need to stop blaming mothers for things that are really social problems. But I don't want to blame teachers either because, you know, they are expected to do so much with a lot less. And we've, you know, all of these standardized tests and all of this kind of surveillance that teachers are under. And of course, that makes it really hard also to teach to different learning styles and kids with different kinds of unique and more individual needs when, you know, you're having larger class sizes and you're so concerned about all the ways that you're being surveilled by test results. And kids stressed out too by all these tests they have to take. So, I mean, I think we've gotten in a real bind as a nation in this. You know, I think I don't want to demonize any professionals. In many ways, we know what's needed is, you know, there have been really good studies, randomized, controlled, experimental studies, where we know that kids and their families do much, much better with wraparound social supports, wraparound kind of supports, you know, in the community with, you know, lots, you know, also counseling, also support groups for families and for the kids, for summer camps, you know, for the kids, all of these kinds of things, as well as some medication. But what was found is that the kids would do well when you compared, you know, the wraparound supports and the medication to sort of either treatment alone or no treatment, is that those kids who had the wraparound treatments and the medication did best. But, you know, the interesting thing, and since it lasted over time, and the parents were much less stressed, and they could get by with much lower doses of the medications. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind, because then you can lessen those kind of troubling side effects, like not eating and lack of appetite, which is a really common side effect of some of these medications. And so I think that's very important to realize that this is not, we don't need to wait for, you know, more neuroscientific discoveries, more mapping of the brain, or more, you know, pharmacological innovations. We know what would work, but it's just the, you know, we have to see this as kind of in all our interests, which, you know, we did back in the 1970s, and when we were passing disability rights legislation, the thinking was, the belief then was quite different, that inclusion, social inclusion of all kinds of differences of bodies and of, you know, and of brains would be good for, it would be good for children. It would be good for all children. And we've gotten really far away from that. And that would be my hope, is that we could reinvigorate that. And that's what I really hope to accomplish with this book.
At the 50,000 foot view, families raising kids who have these disabilities have it hard, or at least sometimes have it hard. They face challenges that other families don't. And that's across the board. And certainly it would seem that it is more challenging for families that don't have the resources of money or time to get the services that maybe aren't publicly available. On the other end of the spectrum, though, and I think this is important, in many middle and upper middle class communities these days, it's not enough to raise kids who just complete school as average students. Everybody is working overtime to crank out kids ready for Harvard, and anything less is seen as a sort of failure in certain communities.
Yeah, I think that's very true. You know, I kind of hate when people also criticize those such mothers and say, you know, this helicopter parenting, and, you know, they just want to have these perfect kids. You know, I feel more sympathetic than that, because I think the decline of really good opportunities in our country is real. And we all want to protect our kids. You know, we all want them to have the benefits that we had. And it's really hard to see that, you know, we're going to have downward mobility. We have an economy, you know, from the 50,000 foot view, where, you know, our nation's largest employer is Walmart. You know, and so when your child is you know, precariously normal, high functioning in some ways and not in others, you know, you're right to be worried. I mean, mother said things to me like, my son is either going to at MIT or working at Blockbuster. And then it's like, wow, you know, a year or two later, Blockbuster even is bankrupt. You know, mm-hmm. even yeah. that opportunity is not there anymore. So we have this, you know, this sense that their futures are precarious, but that in many ways is a public problem that we face as a nation. It's just that these mothers in some ways kind of on the vanguard of that change, and maybe in some ways more aware of it. So I mean, the advantages that you do get if your child goes to Harvard, that's very real. You know, they're not making that up.
Right.
That's quite real. So I think that the problem is we need to stop blaming mothers and say, how can we correct this very disordered opportunity structure? It's not mothers raising disordered kids that's the problem. It's that we have a very disordered economy right now of have and have nots.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jasmine is on the line now in Richardson. Oh, Yasmin, I'm sorry. Hi, Yasmin.
Sorry. Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my question. I have a three-year-old, six son. We're hoping he's high-functioning, but it's kind of hard to tell this early on. Basically, I just want to, like, I have some family members who are still in denial, who say, oh, you know, you're jumping the gun. But is it easier socially for him later, for us to tell friends and family about his diagnosis? Will they be more accepting, more sympathetic, get their kids to kind of be nicer? Or is it better to kind of not mention it and hope that they don't notice the quirky differences, or, you know, they'll include him more? Basically, like, what's better for his future emotionally, you know, to kind of get him more included and not go through all the isolation that you earlier mentioned?
Really interesting question. Thanks so much for your call, Yasmin. Any thoughts, Linda?
Yes, great question. I mean, this is also what we know from sociology, is that, you know, stigma raises these kind of questions, that there's always a question of should you disclose or should you try to pass? And this is also what I heard from mothers, that this is ongoing in every context, every new situation, meeting new families, different relatives, different classroom and teachers. Should you disclose or should you try to have your child pass as normal to neurotypical? And it's a really tough question. And I think there's not one answer. I think that what I learned is that there are risks in either decision, because you risk, if you disclose, you know, that may prevent certain kinds of problems, protect your child in some ways, but in other ways, then that's more stigmatizing with the label. But on the other hand, if you encourage your child to pass, and you're passing as well, and then there are particular, you know, problematic incidents, your child, you know, has a meltdown in something that could have maybe been prevented. First of all, you feel terrible. You feel just awful. But then, you know, also that you're wondering, should I have disclosed, you know, and am I seen as a very irresponsible mother because I'm not aware of my child's issues? So I don't think there's any one answer. And it really, that's part of the work of rearing a child like this, is it's really not one point in time. These kinds of questions are going to be ongoing in rearing your child.
Linda, if mothers are taking on most of the burden of, and burden is maybe the wrong word, but are taking on most of the responsibility of seeking out services and care for their children with these kinds of disabilities, how do they cope with the additional stress? What did you learn about that?
Well, it's very hard. I think as one of the previous caller expressed, it's very hard on the family as a whole. And I think we know particularly that it's very hard on marriages and partnerships. so they're questioning how to do that. I think it becomes something where mothers are really cobbling together what they can. You know, we have, I tried to talk to women with very different kinds of households, because we have diverse households now in the U.S. We don't have everyone with the nuclear family, a mom and dad and two kids anymore. So some, you know, some do get that support from their extended family, and that's, you know, a great thing. That's a pretty great thing when you can call on your extended family. Others who feel like they're not understanding of that, then that's really then a lot harder. And again, it's a lot harder if you can't buy some support for yourself, you know, through finding your own, you know, counselors, psychologists, therapists, you know, these kinds of things. I think it's very hard to find support groups. I was surprised that it was difficult to find support groups. I think, again, the stigma and whether to disclose, you know, gets in the way of looking for that social support, which I had hoped there would, you know, over time be much more of that.
Linda M. Blum's new book is called Raising Generation RX, Mothering Kids with Invisible Disabilities in an Age of Inequality. Linda, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day. We'll